Let's play some cards.
From Harrah's St. Louis Casino and Hotel, this is The Final Table, starring Team Poker Stars pro Dennis Phillips with Paul Harrah's. Brought to you by Poker Stars and the Poker Players Alliance.
Winner, winner, chicken dinner.
You got it.
Now, from the Harrah's St. Louis Poker Room, here are Dennis and Paul on 590 The Fan KFNS.
Thank you, sir. May I have another?
Welcome to Harrah's St. Louis, table number 2 in the poker room. I am Paul Harrah's, sitting here without my partner, Dennis Phillips, who is at the Latin American Poker Tour in Argentina. He has made several trips to South America for PokerStars.net and the Latin American Poker Tour over the last couple of years. And every time he goes, I know that it's going to be a dicey proposition to get him on the phone. For some reason, there's always trouble connecting. Even when I just call him from my cell phone to his cell phone, you know, when you cross the international borders, particularly when you cross the continental borders, things get a little dicey. So we're hoping to hook up with Dennis here in just a couple of minutes, and he can fill us in on what he's doing down there. Also coming up this hour, a little closer to home, from his home in Las Vegas, is Ed Miller. Ed is a poker writer who I met back in February at the Venetian at the NAPT event. He was sitting one table away from me and playing in the NAPT. Ed has written 5 books and done 4 poker DVDs. Some of those books he's written with David Sklansky, who is probably one of the genius writers of our game. Ed's most recent book is Small Stakes, No Limit Hold'em. And this is a topic that we do not cover nearly enough on this show. We know we have lots of listeners who don't go to international tournaments and aren't playing in huge cash games and aren't going to end up on high-stakes poker, but are coming, whether it's the grind out some cash or just for recreational purposes, to come and play in low limit games, like for instance the 1-2 game here at Harrah's St. Louis, or a 1-3 game or a 2-5 game here. We don't talk about those sort of things enough, so Ed will be along a little bit later on in this hour to talk about strategy regarding small stakes, no limit hold'em. As I mentioned, Dennis is at the LAPT Rosario. That's in Argentina. It is far from the only tournament going on now. The Asia-Pacific Poker Tour is going on in Auckland, New Zealand. The WPT has a huge event going on at the Borgata, which I'll talk about in just a second. And the World Series of Poker has their annual WSOPE. That's the World Series of Poker Europe that's going on. And congratulations to friend of the show, Phil Locke, who we had on this summer after he set a new world record for playing 115 consecutive hours in the 10-20 game at the Bellagio out in Las Vegas. He was on with us the following week and told about those exploits. And by the way, if you missed that show, you can listen to the podcast by going to Dennis's website, thechipleader.com. You can download that or any of our 85 previous shows. This is our 86th show today. All of those shows are on there, or you can subscribe via iTunes and get them that way. So Phil Locke, who pulled off that marathon this summer and then a few weeks ago was involved in an ATV accident where he nearly lost an eye, all of this has somehow turned him into a bracelet winner because he took down event number 1 at the WSOPE. That was the 2,500-pound 6-max no-limit event. This is Phil's first bracelet, which means he's now tied for a number of bracelets in his own household with his longtime girlfriend, Jennifer Tilley. She won one a couple of years ago in the ladies' event at the WSOP in Las Vegas. This is Phil's first ever win in a big open tourney. He has played on Poker After Dark and High Stakes Poker and the Big Game and lots of other televised poker events where, of course, he's always a big tune-in factor because of the Unabomber hoodies and the fact that he loves to talk at the table. He's a great attraction on TV, and he's a pretty good cash game player, but has not had tremendous success in tournaments until now. And so congratulations to Phil for taking down World Series of Poker event number one. Also, congratulations to Jeffrey Lissandro, who was Player of the Year at the World Series of Poker last year for taking down three bracelets in the same year. Now he's gotten another one. It is his fifth overall. He took down event number two at the WSOPE, the 5K PLO event. So congratulations to him as well. And now I think we've got Dennis finally on the line from Argentina at the LAPT. Are you there, Dennis?
Yep, I'm here. Sorry about that. I had a little bit of storm down here, and my connection may not be the best in the world, but I think everything's okay now and up and running.
Okay, well, before we talk about what you were are going to be involved in, because I know you just arrived there, I was talking about the WSOPE, and I was about to mention a guy who I know you know very well named Chris Bjorn, who is a Scandinavian guy.
Yeah.
He now lives in London. He finished third in event one at the WSOPE and then finished ninth in event number two. He has final tabled four of these WSOP events in the last 6 years. He's got 57 caches in the WSOP in Las Vegas. He's got a couple of bracelets. And here's an amazing stat about Chris. In the last 22 years, he has earned a six-figure tournament income in 17 of those years. That's remarkable, isn't it?
It is, if you think back, because he was doing this in years when there weren't that many tournaments around, they were not that big, and the payouts weren't that big. You compute that now, I mean, people are, you can almost add another zero to the back end of it, is what he was doing on a yearly basis. So I've had the privilege of playing with him a few times. I know him fairly well. He's a guy that you will almost never see make a bad play. He is so solid in his game. He's difficult to play against because of that, and I tell you, I got a lot of respect for him. I really don't like him sitting at my table, with a lot of chips at least.
You know what's funny about this is we talked about him just a few weeks ago when ESPN's telecast of the main event started, and Chris was at a table with Annette Oberstad, and they got into a hand, and he beat her, and she berated him. And we made it clear on this show how obvious it must be to anyone who knows anything about poker that she has never heard of Chris Bjorn. You know, she's only 21 years old, and, you know, you can't expect her to know who every person at her table is. But if there's anybody in tournament poker you probably don't want to be calling a donkey, this is the guy.
That's putting it very, very politely and politically correct, because I'm telling you, a lot of other people would have said a lot worse. This guy is as solid as they get. He's as good as they get. He's best friends with guys such as, Phil Ivey he knows real well. I mean, Eric Seidel, and he go to dinner a lot of times. Tremendous amount of respect for this guy on his poker playing. And for Annette to say that, clearly she was way off base.
All right, enough about the WSOPE. Tell us about the LAPT in Rosario, Argentina, which I know you literally just got there a little while ago after having to travel for how many hours?
Oh, it's unbelievable. We left St. Louis yesterday at a little after 4. So obviously we're there at the airport a couple hours ahead of that. We got down here to the hotel at 1:30. So, yeah, not quite 24 hours of traveling, but close enough to it.
Wow.
A lot of traveling anyhow. We traveled from there to Dallas, a little layover in Dallas, from Dallas to Buenos Aires. From Buenos Aires then, Rosario is about a three-hour drive under normal conditions. However, as it turned out, we did not have normal conditions. We got within about 40 miles of the town and ran into a parking lot on the highway. It turns out that one of the construction companies had just lost their contract on working on an overpass, and they decided that if they couldn't work on the overpass, nobody should be able to drive through it. And they set up a protest and blockade, and they blocked the whole highway.
Lovely.
We ended up having to go way the heck out. We went through a small town here and got an indoctrination into Argentina in the area you don't really want to be in. The road went from a four-lane highway to a two-lane highway to an asphalt road to, I think it was not much more than packed dirt. And the driver rolling the window down and hollering at somebody about how does he get to Rosario, and we're looking around at houses, the few that were actually occupied that had, iron bars on the windows. And It was interesting. Let's put it that way.
This is the life of an international poker star, Dennis Phillips. Yeah, you get to go and play in poker tournaments all over the world, but sometimes you have a little bit of trouble getting there.
It was hilarious. The driver didn't seem to be bothered at all, but I'm telling you, let's put it this way. I'm really glad we didn't have a flat tire.
So this event that you're there to play starts tomorrow. What is the event? How many people are they expecting? And what was it like last time you were there?
Well, this is the grand finale. This is the culmination of all of the LAPTs that they've held down here in Peru and Uruguay and all the rest of them, Costa Rica and such. And this is the one where all of the other champions come to. This is the one that's got the biggest payout. It's a $5,000 event, and they're going to have several hundred people down here. Poker is just growing by leaps and bounds in Latin America. It's huge. I can almost guarantee that in a couple of days, the front page of the local newspaper will have a big splash about the poker tournament going on here. And we got a very pleasant surprise when we pulled up to the casino. This is a gorgeous place. It's called City Center, and it is huge. There's three different levels of the casino, nice big area for the poker tournament. I think there's, I don't know, half a dozen different restaurants. Very, very nice place set up here. And I know the way the guys have been running the LAPTs. I know it's going to be run well. We're going to have a ton of people down there, a lot of qualifiers. In fact, I got a shock. Tim Vance from up there by St. Louis is actually qualified and is going to be down here playing, along with a number of other people that are coming down here. So this should be a good time. It's always run well by the PokerStars staff, and they just try to take care of you and make sure that the player comes first. You can't ask for much more than that.
Well, terrific, and good luck in the event that starts tomorrow. Speaking of big turnouts, I mentioned that there are so many different tournaments going on where you are. The LAPT, the APPT is going on in Auckland, the WSOPE in London, and the WPT has an event going on at the Borgata, which had its biggest WPT field ever. 1,042 people are in this event.
Wow.
Now, we talked to Matt Savage last week about changes that they've made in WPT, and one of those is that they're not all 10K or higher buy-in events. I think they've tried to make the WPT accessible. But I wanted to tell you about a controversial hand that happened there on, I don't know if this was on day 1A or 1B, but there's a guy named Mike who raised all in pre-flop and got called by two other players. And the flop came 7-4 deuce with two clubs. And Mike, according to WPT officials, said goodbye to the table and walked away. Now, remember, there are two other players in the hand. So the dealer reached over and mucked his cards, thinking that Mike had conceded. Mike then turns back and sees an ace hit the turn and comes back and says, wait a second. Hold on, I didn't fold my hand. He started protesting, made them call over a floor supervisor who ruled that you walked away from the table and your hand was mucked, and once it's in the muck, there's nothing anybody can do. So Mike is fuming about this. He stands there and he watches as one of the other two players, the guy who was in the big blind, makes a small bet. The third player folds. Mike tries to reach into the muck and pull over his cards. He flips over a nine, he flips over a queen, he flips over a king. None of those would have helped him win the hand, but he's already been told that he lost the hand, and they gave all the chips to the small blind, who did later say that he had ace-queen in that hand for a big ace with a big kicker. But you got to wonder what was going through this guy's mind when you're all in and the hand is not over yet to leave the table with a hand, by the way, that you raised these guys all in pre-flop. Well, I mean, what are you doing there? Maybe he did it with ace-king, and when the board came out three rags, he missed, but walking away while your tournament life is on the line, does that make sense to you?
Not even close. I've seen people make moves like that before. As far as I'm concerned, the dealer did nothing wrong. You have, quote, abandoned your hand. You've left it, you've left nothing to protect it, and you have walked away from the table, stood up and walked away from the table. Your hand is over.
Yep.
I don't see anything or any way to justify any different. Now, if he'd have been, quote, lucky enough that the dealer had not done his job and had left the card sitting there, that's one thing. But clearly, he is walking away. Clearly, you know, he's not there to protect his hand or do anything. I'm sorry, if I was the dealer, I'd be raking those cards in.
Now, I'll tell you how I can see this being different. Let's say there aren't three players in it, but just Mike and one other player. Because when at that point, when you're heads up, you both have to table your cards face up. And at that point,
correct,
if Mike walks away, it doesn't matter because we see what his cards are. The hand is going to play out, and whether he's standing there or not, if he wins, they're going to push the chips to him, even if he has left the room, right?
That's absolutely right. That's a totally different scenario. That's like comparing apples and oranges. When your cards are face up and everything is done, there can be nothing different. You know, yeah, no problem. You stand up, you can walk around, whatever. But I'm telling you what, his cards were face down. He wasn't protecting them. He abandoned the cards. He abandoned the table. No, as far as I'm concerned, that was a no-brainer for the floor person. The dealer did the correct thing, and hopefully Mike learned a lesson there. I don't know how he could even get upset with anybody, to be honest.
Yep, I agree with you 100%. Interesting lesson for everybody who's going to be playing tournament poker, or cash game poker, for that matter, to learn. Now, before we go to a break and then bring on noted poker authority, Ed Miller, that's his website, notedpokerauthority.com. before we bring him in and talk about some small stakes cash game play, let's talk about the WCOOP, the World Championship of Online Poker, which you've been playing on PokerStars.net. And when I called you on Sunday, you were in the middle of playing something and you got involved in an interesting hand. Do you want to talk about the 6-7 hand?
Why not? Playing in the WCOOP, massive in pots, massive amount of players, some really interesting play. I was sitting on a suited 6-7 in the big blind. Several folds. One guy just makes a mid-raise, just basically about a 2.2 raise. Comes around to me. I go ahead to see the flop. It's fairly cheap. This is a fairly aggressive player. I'm pretty sure if he's putting some money out there, you know, that if I hit this flop, I can collect on it. Anyhow, the flop comes a 9-8-7. So I have third pair and an open end. I check. He makes a standard bet. Nothing abnormal about this or anything like that. He would be doing this if he had ace-queen, if he had a number of different hands. I smooth called it there. Now, again, argument can be made for raising it there, trying to take down the pot. You know, there's lots of different things, but I just smooth called it. Turns a two. I check again. Now, he bets out, but he only bets less than 25% of the pot. I'm looking at a decent number of outs. I'm also looking that I might be able to buy the pot if a danger card comes on the river. So there are some implied outs there. There's a whole variety of different things that could happen there. So I smooth call again. Now, again, if somebody just calls you pre-flop, smooth calls you on the flop, and smooth calls you on the turn, all sorts of things should be going on through your head, and a lot of them should be alarm bells. Well, the river card is a 7. Now, that could be potentially a perfect card for me because it's such a hidden card. What hand is he going to put me on that I would be calling him with just a bare 7? Now, maybe a 7-10, maybe the 6-7, but other than that, I'm probably not going to be calling him. Now, granted, you got to be aware of this because he could have had a Jack-10. He's the type of player that would play that. He could have flopped the set and be trying to bet for value out here the whole time. I'm faced with a little bit of dilemma then. I assume I have the best hand. I want to be a little bit careful in playing this. I've smooth-called him and smooth-called him. Do I then lead out with a value bet to try and get something? Do I check, hoping he'll take one more shot at this pot, especially if he missed everything? He had like an ace, king, or ace, queen. The only way he's going to win it is to take a shot at it. Or do I overbet the pot and actually throw it out there where it looks like I could have missed or it looks like I could be bluffing and see if I can't take down a monster pot here? Makes for quite the dilemma. Any idea on how you would play that, Paul?
Well, what did you put him on when he bet so little, only about a quarter of the pot, on the turn? I'm thinking to myself, he either has air or he's got a monster. There's no way he's got something like ace 9 or even 10-9, or anything in the middle there, you know, or even a pair of jacks or anything like that. I'm putting him on either he's flopped a set or he's got ace king or ace queen, and he's missed completely. That's what I would have been thinking when he bet so small on the turn. I think that's where he made a mistake by not trying to buy the pot out from under you at that point. What do you say?
It absolutely was, and that's why I brought that out. He did not make a standard bet there of any kind. He made such a small bet. Now, is that an enticement to keep me into it, an enticement to get me to re-raise, or is it a feeler to see if I'm going to be willing to throw anything out? What the heck is this bet? I could even add a few more hands that he could have had there. He could have had a small pair. He could have had, like, pocket fives where he has a gut shot and the fives. And if I didn't have a 7, 8, or 9, you know, maybe he can push me off.
Yep.
Maybe he thinks I'm on some sort of a draw with an ace 10 or something where
yep.
I've got two overcards and a 10.
Right.
So, you know, there's lots of different things there. He could have a small pair. He could have, again, I would even put him, you know, on a variety of different nine hands, a queen nine, a 10 nine, an ace nine, a variety of things that way. So there's a whole variety of hands he had. But unless he did the monster, unless he flopped the set, in all likelihood, I've got the best hand there. So I've got to try to extract value. But again, I'm trying to be careful not put my tournament life on the line. We've had that discussion before. Remember when Joe has come on there? He says, you know, you can't go rebuy chips in a tournament. These are so valuable. You need to be a little careful with it, not go nuts and not be overly aggressive. So I didn't want to risk my entire tournament there. And the thing of it is, if I make a big bet and he comes over the top, then what the heck do I do? So it was a bit of a dilemma. I think I have the best hand. I want to extract some value, but I don't want to get into a shoving war.
So you checked.
You know. Pardon?
So you check.
So I checked. Do you remember what he did?
I think at that point he didn't shove, did he? No. I can't remember. I assume that he just bet probably about 50% of the pot.
That's exactly what he did. It was actually a little bit less. It was like 40% of the pot. I came over the top, and he couldn't get his cards thrown away fast enough.
Hmm.
So I really don't know what he had, but I think I probably got about the maximum value out of that hand.
Yeah.
I think if I'd have let out, he would have folded. There's a variety of ways to play. You never know till the end exactly what it was. I think the only other possibility is if I'd have made a stab at the pot that looked like I was trying to buy the pot, he might have taken a hard swallow and re-raised me to try and push me back off of it, but I doubt if that would have happened. I think probably letting him commit that third bullet was about the best way I could get any money out of him.
I agree with you. You stayed out of danger and at the same time get a few extra chips out of him. And now you've got his really valuable chips, and he doesn't have them anymore. That's Dennis right. playing in the W Coupe on PokerStars.net on Sunday. W Coupe is not done yet, is it?
No, not even close. They've got the main event coming up here before very long. And I'm telling you what, it's going to be awesome. It's a $10 million guarantee. And you can go to PokerStars.net, download the information, and go on there and start playing in the free rolls and qualify for a seat at that. We are going to have literally thousands of people in this event. It's a $10 million guarantee for this thing. Awesome and unbelievable. So you guys need to get on there. If you want to play poker, if you're serious about it, this is the place to play. I'm telling you, it's unreal.
We should also mention that last week and the week before, you mentioned that PokerStars.net was doing a promotion where they were going to be dealing their 50 billionth hand sometime this month. I saw on their site
right.
today that they expect that hand to hit tomorrow, Wednesday, September 22nd. I mentioned that because some of our listeners are listening to podcasts and may not know exactly when tomorrow is, but they expect the 50 billionth hand to hit sometime on Wednesday, and whoever's online and in a hand at that time is going to gain untold riches. So for more information, go to PokerStars.net and find a PokerStar in you. We take a break here at the final table. When we come back, Ed Miller, who has written some terrific poker books, including his newest on small stakes, No Limit Hold'em, will join us. Dennis Phillips is at the LAPT in Rosario, Argentina. I'm Paul Harris at Table 2 at Harrah's St. Louis. Thanks for listening to The Final Table from Harrah's St. Louis on 590 The Fan KFNS and KFNS.com. Welcome back to The Final Table from the poker room of Harrah's St. Louis with Dennis Phillips on the phone from Argentina, where he's playing in the Latin American Poker Tour. I am Paul Harris. Before we bring our guest on, a quick reminder that this Sunday here at Harrah's St. Louis, somebody's going to win a car. It's Mean versus Green. You get your choice of a mean Chevy Camaro or a green smart car. Somebody's going to win it this Sunday, September 26th. Bring in your entries that you've been picking up every Sunday through September. Somebody will drive away a winner, guaranteed. And if you're a fan of chicken dinners, tomorrow night, Wednesday night, is the night to come to the Eat Up Buffet here, where they've got eight different styles of their famous fried chicken, the original, the honey, buffalo, jalapeno, crispy cornflake crusted, and more, all for just $16.99. It's an all-new chicken dinner and all-you-can-eat at the Eat Up Buffet at Harrah's St. Louis. And if you're waiting for the crab legs, those are not on Wednesdays. They are on Thursdays and Fridays for $24.99. Yet another reason to come to Harrah's St. Louis, the home of the Final Table. Our guest today is Ed Miller, who has done four poker DVDs and five books, including a couple that he wrote with David Sklansky. His latest is called Small Stakes, No Limit Hold'em. You might have read his columns in Card Player magazine, or a few years back, you might have seen him as the subject of a makeover on Queer Eye for the Straight Guy. Ed, welcome to the Final Table.
Hi, how are you?
Doing great. Thanks for joining us on the show here. Dennis and I have talked off the air about how we don't talk enough on the air about small stakes cash games. I mean, I'm sitting here at Harrah's right now, and there are several tables of people playing 1-2, and there's 2-5 games that get going here later in the week. We tend to talk about the big events that Dennis is playing in or the bigger cash games that I play in. So we're happy to have you on talking about small stakes, no limit hold'em. Tell us right up front a couple of mistakes that small stakes players make in their games.
Sure. Well, the biggest one is they play out of position with weak hands. They'll call raises like that. So I was playing in a game actually just this weekend. It was a 1-2 game, and a couple guys limped for $2, you know, $2, $2, $2. And then I made it 25 with aces, and I got call. and pretty much guaranteed, no matter what they had, it was a really just horrible mistake they made calling. But, you know, whenever you're playing in a game like that, you know you can get those calls with your aces, so you might as well make the big raise.
Well, I got a question for you. I get asked all the time. You're playing a cash game, so it's a lot different than a tournament game. Just how weak a hand can you still get involved in a pot when you have, quote, pot odds, when you're the fifth person or the sixth person? Now, I know if you get some suited connectors or you get a small pair, it's an easy call. But can you make that call with a 5-3 of clubs, or can you make that with an ace-4 or something like that? How widespread is your hand when you get four or five other people in the pot?
You know, if it's like, you know, three guys limp to you for $2, you can play, especially if you're on the button, you know, you can play, you know, I mean, 5-3 suited, yeah, sure, $2, you know. Or ace-4 offsuit, probably I wouldn't bother because in multi-way pot. But the thing is, and I think this is sort of the important point, is that's not really how you make your money in these no-limit games. I mean, the difference between calling for $2 with 5-3 suited and not calling, you know, with 5-3 suited for $2, and even similar hands over a lifetime of play is really like a tiny amount of money. And I think people kind of focus on that a lot. And the thing is, I think that more importantly is to get raises in when you have better but not great hands. And that's what I would focus more on. So instead of saying, well, can I limp in for $2 with 5-3 suited? Okay, do what you want. You know, but if you have, say, pocket eights and a couple people limp to you, that's a raising hand. And I think that's sort of the more key point, I would say.
And let's talk about the quality of raises, because you talked about playing a 1-2 game and you had aces and you made $25.
Right, yes.
to me, I see somebody do that and I think to myself, there's no way he has less than, I'm going to go with aces or kings.
Right.
You know, he's never making that move with eights, particularly if the normal raise of that table, well, people in a 1-2 game tend not to raise to $6 or $7 anymore. It's now $10 or $15 at a lot of these games. But you make it 25, and aren't you telegraphing what your hand is?
Yeah, I mean, it depends on how you play other hands. I mean, as you said, sort of the quote-unquote standard raise size at this table was $10 to $15, you know, so it was not you know, unreasonable for somebody certainly to make it 15 in that situation. And, you know, I find, honestly, I mean, I would have made it 25 there, possibly even with eights. I mean, it depends on the stack sizes and so forth. As long as I know people are going to call, I mean, what's the difference? You know, as long as if my hand's worth a raise, given the stack sizes, and if I know people are going to call, then, yeah, I'll do it with aces, and I'll do it with other raising hands, too. But yeah, in that game, I wouldn't say it didn't stick way out because people were making it 15, so my 25 was, like, you know, not totally like, hey, I've got aces.
I actually think you raised a very good point there about people in the smaller stakes a lot of times don't seem to raise enough. You get to playing in one of these high-stakes games, a cash game, every hand is raised virtually. A lot of times re-raised. You go down there and you play a 2-5 or something. It seems like you have some players that almost never raise unless they have a premium hand. I think that's in-position raises are vital to it if you want to be profitable on this at that level.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that's a total key. If I had to sit someone down and say, what's the first thing I'm going to show them is I'm going to show them how to raise with position and then play that position after the flop. That would be my sort of like lesson number one to how to really win a ton of these games.
All right, Ed, I started off by asking you what small stakes players do wrong. What do small stakes players do right?
Well, some of them barely do anything right. But I would say a lot of guys in these, especially 2-5, 1-2, you know, a lot of 1-2 players really are have no idea what they're doing. But, you know, especially in Vegas, a lot of them are tourists and really almost never play poker. But the sort of regular 1-2 players, guys that come, you know, to the card room, you know, 4 days a week, guys that play 2-5, one thing they do, I would say, is they know how to get away from hands that are beaten after the flop. You know, they're generally speaking, and there are obviously exceptions, but a lot of these guys know how to get away from top pair. You know, if you really start, you know, betting half your stack at them, they know that means top pair is no good anymore, and they'll fold. So, and that's good, obviously. So that's the thing I think they do best is get away from those kind of little bitty trap hands.
Well,
after the flop.
Well, nuts, Ed. I just written down how do you get away from the hands, and I was from top. Never mind. You just answered my question before I got to ask it.
Yeah.
So, you know, well done there. All right.
Thank you.
Got another question. A lot of it's actually not even a question, but I wouldn't mind you commenting upon it. I know several guys that they're more or less grinders. I will admit that. They can sit down at a 2-5 table and make $400, $500, $600, and then, you know, walk away from there perfectly happy. If you do the math, you play 3-4 times a week, you're trying to just get $500 at a time, you realize that's $2,000 a week, you realize that's $100,000 in a year. A lot of people don't do the small math there that adds up to the big math.
That would be a big winner, I mean, to win that much in a year, but it's certainly possible. I would say it's possible if you put in a lot of hours to win that much in a 2-5 game, for sure.
Oh, I don't think many people do. Don't get me wrong on that. But
yeah.
I'm just saying that some guys sit down there with a 1,000 in front of them, and, I need to at least triple this up before I can even think about leaving. The heck you do.
Yeah.
You know, good grief. It's so easy to actually build up a nice, solid bankroll by just grinding it out. If you want to get in there and make some profit and do it, play good, solid poker, pick your hands, play your position strong, and just grind it out and be willing to leave the table when, you know, you get a decent profit.
And, Dennis, you and I both know plenty of people here in St. Louis during the heyday a few years ago where you would come to Harrah's on a Thursday, Friday, or Saturday night, and there would be 4 or 5 2-5 games going on. And there were plenty of grinders who were in here racking up their $500, $600 win on a regular basis and taking that money home and coming back next time and doing the same thing all over again. It is not an uncommon occurrence, or it wasn't an uncommon occurrence here. I don't know what it's like there in Vegas for you. But, Ed, I would guess that part of the difference for you is we in St. Louis are not a poker destination, except when we have the circuit event in April. Vegas, of course, on the other hand, is. So you've got to decide when you sit down at a table, is this guy just a recreational player, or is this one of the local grinders?
Right. Yeah, well, that's absolutely true. And I would say in Vegas, because of that phenomenon, there's sort of more variation and how the games play here. You know, you'll sit in one table, you know, and you'll see seven faces you don't recognize, and you'll be like, oh, this must be a great table, and then you find out, oh, it's seven guys who are on vacation, grinders from, you know, Minnesota or St. Louis or wherever, and they're here on vacation to play poker, and, oh, the game's actually not that good. And then some days you sit down, and there's seven faces you don't recognize, and it's just, you know, crazy town. You know, the circus is in town, and you know, these guys are all here to blow off money. So, it's usually pretty easy to figure out, you know, within a few hands what you're dealing with, you know, and you can just look for some really simple things just to tell the difference.
One difference that we used to have in St. Louis and we don't anymore, and it actually had some good sides to it, was the $500 limit to, quote, protect the player, I guess. We used to have a $500 buy-in limit every 2 hours, where all you could do was spend $500. If you busted, you had to wait till the magical 2 hours were gone, and then you could rebuy in for $500. Now, granted, as Paul knows and I know, there were ways to get around that by stockpiling chips, by buying chips from other players. There's a lot of different ways that we got around that. But I actually think a lot of people, it forced them, knowing that these were the only chips and that they would have to stand around or couldn't even play if they lost them all, to actually play a little better. And it actually wasn't a bad learning ground for some players, putting that limitation on them. So we had some great 2-5 games going in St. Louis, didn't we, Paul?
Yeah, we did. Now, one of the interesting things to me is if you are, let's say, a person who plays in 5-10 games or maybe bigger games, and you show up in a poker room, whether it's here in St. Louis or there in Vegas or in Tunica or Chicago or L.A. or anywhere else, you're not always going to get that seat in the game you want, and you might have to sit down in one of these small stakes games. And Ed, I'd like you to talk a little bit about the pitfalls of the guys who usually play mid stakes games, and by that I mean 5, 10, 10 and a quarter, and in that range, and they sit down at a 1-2 table to kill time or a 2-5 table to kill time until their seat's going to open up, and how they have to understand that play is different there than what they may be used to.
Right. I would say there's sort of two areas where guys can be led astray. First of all, before I say any of this, I think a regular 5-10 player, 10-20 player, or someone who wins in those games will also win in a 1-2 or 2-5 game, you know, even without these pitfalls. Those skills do translate. But there are a couple things to watch out for. One is the big multi-way pots that happen sometimes in low-limit games, you know, especially 3-bet pots. I mean, you'll see... You know, say in this, in fact, you know, I played a hand like this weekend in this 1-2 game I was talking about where someone made it 15 before the flop and there were like three calls, and then someone made it 50 and everyone called. So this is a 1-2 game, so the stacks are $200, $300, and it was five ways for $50 each. Well, when the pot there is now like already as big as someone's stack, and it's an interesting situation because you have to commit your stack then, you know, more lightly. You can't just kind of say, you know, if someone bets all in, you can't say, oh, well, that's a huge hand, let me fold. You have to kind of know where that line is that says, okay, well, you know, the pot's so big now, I have to just kind of gamble with whatever I have. And that's a pitfall. I mean, that's a situation you rarely get into in a 10-20 game. You're not going to have, you know, five guys in for – you know, $300 each or $400 each, usually. So it's a situation you're not going to have seen before really very much. And then here you are, and now you've got some marginal hand. You've got middle pair, and you're like, do I stick my money in? And, you know, and the answer sometimes is yes, you know, depending. So that's one situation. And then the other one I would say is definitely, especially pre-flop. When guys re-raise pre-flop, you know, as you were saying before, in a 10-20 game, that means that can be, you know, a lot of hands because the guy's just aggressive. But in a low-limit game, often that means aces. And so you have to really be careful with hands like ace-queen or, you know, tens maybe, you know, once guys re-raise you.
All right, we're going to take a break, and then we're going to come back with more with Ed Miller. NotedPokerAuthority.com is his website. His latest book is Small Stakes, No Limit Hold'em. Dennis Phillips is in Argentina. Ed is in Las Vegas. I'm Paul Harris here at Table 2 at Harris St. Louis, the home of the Final Table. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter, Dennis_Phillips or Paul Harris Show are the ways you can get us there, or get our podcast from the website, thechipleader.com, or via iTunes. And when you go to thechipleader.com, look for the shop button, and you can get our Final Table merchandise, shirts and sweatshirts and hats and so much more, all available there at thechipleader.com. This is 5-9 of the Fan KFNS and KFNS.com. This is the weekly poker show, The Final Table, coming to you from table number 2 at Harrah's St. Louis in the poker room. I'm Paul Harris. My partner Dennis Phillips is in Argentina getting ready to play the main event of the Latin American Poker Tour finale in Rosario, Argentina tomorrow. And joining us on the phone today is our guest Ed Miller, whose website is notedpokerauthority.com, where you can order the 4 poker DVDs he's done and 5 books now, including his latest called Small Stakes, No Limit Hold'em. Ed, we were talking before the break about players in larger games sitting down in smaller games and some of the pitfalls. I find that one of the things that a lot of guys at that level do when they sit down is they tend to think of the money as being so small, and they're used to playing for much more, that they get involved in more hands. And also they're playing what I call fancy play against what is quite often a table full of simple ABC players, guys who you cannot bluff under any circumstances or make moves on, because with short stacks, they're going to get their money in there, and you're not going to be able to beat them that way. What do you think?
Well, I definitely think both of those things I've seen happen a bunch of times for sure. You know, definitely I've seen guys come in, you know, and play in 1-2, 2-5 games, and really play way too many hands. Just because I think it's just arrogance. You know, they're like, I could beat these guys with 7 deuce, and so then they try.
Yeah.
I definitely that can happen. And the other side of the not being able to bluff people, I think sometimes is I've also seen them actually on the flip side sometimes give guys too much credit. You know, that as you say, a lot of these guys are ABC players. You know, they're playing in a certain way, and I've seen them try to like call a bluff. You know, they're you know, some guy moves in on the river, and then they sit there and think, and then decide to call with like, you know, a bottom pair, because it could be a bluff, and they're used to games where that could be a bluff, and oh well, the guy had a set, you know, surprise. So yeah, that's definitely something I've seen.
One area that I sometimes see a lot of people lacking, at least in my opinion, is value betting, especially with medium hand, but a strong hand. I've seen a lot of people leave money on the table, as far as I'm concerned. I actually think there are times when you can value bet on the turn even. But let's not get involved with that. On the river, value bet for this guy that's playing at the 2-5. Do you see that as a weakness for a lot of players?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you hit the nail on the head, I think. That's the number one thing I talk about in articles, and, you know, in Small Stakes and No Limit Hold'em and other things, is absolutely people do not value bet enough on the river. Hands like top pair. I mean, there are guys that will call 3 streets. The flop comes king, you know, king 7-5 or something, you know, and guys calling down with king 7, that's 2 pair, king 8 or king 3 or something. Some guys will do that, you know, but yet most players at that level are absolutely going to check down ace king, king queen, king jack, all those big kings, without fail. They're going to check it down on the river. They're not going to go for that last bit of value. I just see it over and over and over again.
And it's extracting those few extra chips on every street that build your stack.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk. Yeah, let's talk a little bit about something that I saw you write about recently on your website, notedpokerauthority.com, which is misplaying suited connectors. A lot of people are under the wrong impression about how to play those. Explain what you mean.
Right. So suited connectors, a lot of people think about, okay, it's a speculative hand. You know, maybe I'm going to make a flush, maybe I'll make a straight. And the thinking is, you know, and if I don't flop well, I'm just going to get away from the hand. So that's the thinking. It's just sort of like, if I hit the hand, I'll go with it. If I don't hit the hand, I won't. The problem is that suited connectors don't really hit often enough to play that way. They just the numbers don't work out for that mindset. Um, and you know, so the thing you have to do when you play suited connectors, I think of suited connectors as bluffing hands. That's what I think of them as. You know, when I play them, a guy limps to me, I have 8-7 suited on the button, I'm going to raise that hand. I'm not going to try to limp in and see a cheap flop. That's not what they're about. I'm going to raise the suited connectors on the button, and then maybe I get called. And then maybe I kind of hit the flop a little bit. I flop a gut shot or some kind of middle pair, some kind of, like, weakish draw. I'm going to bluff with that hand and try to win the pot. Not every time. It depends on what my opponent does. But that's my mindset, is I'm going to try to steal enough pots to make that hand profitable.
Do you think that too many people get involved with suited connectors multi-way, so there are 6 or 7 players in there, and they're getting involved with the 6-5 of hearts in the cutoff or on the button, or maybe for a raise, they're calling that raise from the blind, and there are just too many people in there to make that move profitable? Would you tell people fewer people is better for suited connectors?
Well, it's a little complicated. I would say as long as the preflop betting is relatively small, then it's okay to slip in there with a suited connector 7 ways. You know, yeah, I just said they're bluffing hands, and primarily they are. But if you can get in for a small amount on the button or the cutoff with 6-5 suited, that's no big deal. The thing that people do that's wrong with them is, one, they'll limp in early with them and then call a big raise. You do not want to be in a situation where you're playing heads up or 3 ways against a raiser and you're out of position and you have a suited connector. That's a bad situation to be in. I see people do that all the time. You also don't want to call 3 bets. Usually, you don't want to call 3 bets with that hand. And if you are calling 3 bets with that hand, it's absolutely a bluffing hand in that situation, and you need to know what you're doing.
I can agree with almost all of that. I actually am more likely to be in there with a suited connector in late position when I have 3, 4, or 5 people already in there, where I can make a bluff a little easier and such. That's another situation. If I get involved in a hand with suited connectors is a good example, or there's a rather variety of hands, and I have a great draw on the turn, when we were talking about the value bet beforehand, that's where I like to put the value bet out there. Maybe you take the pot down right then. If not, you get enough money in that pot that if you hit it on the river, you can take down a monster pot at times. That's when I make the bluff sometimes on a turn in late position with suited connectors.
Absolutely. That's what I mean by their bluffing hands. If they come up with these situations like that are kind of 2 ways where you can bluff, but then even if you get caught, sometimes you know, make your hand and win a huge one. So, yeah.
Great stuff.
I kind of like doing that way.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, we don't want to give away all the tips from Ed's book. You've got to go to the website, notedpokerauthority.com, and get it. We'll also put a link to it on Dennis's website, thechipleader.com. It's simply called Small Stakes, No Limit Hold'em. If you play 1-2, 1-3, 2-5, maybe even up to 5-10, there'll be some stuff in there that can help make your game better and help you earn that extra bet or two here and there that'll make you a long-term winner. Ed, I know I promised we'd have you on the show 7 months ago. I'm glad I finally was able to come through with that.
Absolutely. No, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you very much. We'll do it again sometime.
All right. Sounds great.
Ed Miller, who is online at notedpokerauthority.com, and you can also read his column in Card Player magazine. This portion of the show brought to you by the Poker Players Alliance, the group that fights for poker players like you and me. They are really pushing hard in Congress to get the companion bill to H.R. 2267 through the House Ways and Means Committee, and then get it attached, if possible, to some legislation to get this taken care of in this short period before Congress goes out again to try to get themselves reelected. If not then, then perhaps during the lame duck session after Election Day, we can get something done. We feel it's fairly urgent to get it done this year, and we can only do it with help from poker players like you. Go to the website, theppa.org. Keep up with all the legislative agenda there and support it for just $20. Premium membership is $20. That's Ed raised more than that with his aces in a 1-2 game. You can certainly put 20 bucks in to help us out. Theppa.org. That's the Poker Players Alliance. All right, Dennis, we've got just a few minutes left to go here, and I want to talk about another friend of the show by the name of Kathy Liebert, who I also met at the NAPT in February because she and I played at a table for a while, and I interviewed her, and we played part of it on the final table back then. But she recently has been taking to Twitter to talk about the coverage of the World Series of Poker, and I guess people wondering why we never see her. And I want to share with you some of what Kathy has tweeted and then get your reaction. She has said, to get on ESPN, you have to either act bitchy or show cleavage or act like a jerk or be condescending. Be a great player doesn't get you on TV. Showing emotion at the poker table is a sign of weakness, but it might make better TV. But best players keep a poker face. She says, when I was younger and immature, I expressed my emotions at the poker table, but now I rarely do. I keep getting asked about sponsorship. Why would sites want to sponsor those that act rudely and make themselves look bad or insult others? ESPN did have cameras on me many times, and if I wanted to get on TV, all I had to do was be insulting or rude or condescending. I didn't do it. I've never tried to ham it up for the cameras. Even when they're on me, I don't do sound bites or act out to get attention. I get asked why I don't get more credit being ranked the number one woman. It is annoying that they think Annie Duke is. And by the way, Annie will be our guest in 2 weeks on this show. She says, in terms of women and sponsorship, sex appeal is probably the biggest requirement, but for men, exposure is more important. Now, I know there are a couple of different things there, but, you know, we've talked about this guy, Ted Bort, who was barking at the main event and got himself lots of coverage. We've seen Phil Hellmuth and Mike Matisau, and a couple of years ago, Hevad Khan, and lots of other players who act badly, who get the attention, and then also get the endorsement dollars. But here's Kathy Liebert, the winningest female poker player in history, who doesn't have a deal with an online website. What do you say about all this, Dennis?
Well, I mean, there's so many things to say there. My mind interrupts as you were saying that to make comments. But, where do I start? Okay, she is right in a lot of this, by the way. But you have players in all sports. You have a John McEnroe, who was, you know, the brat for the tennis. And he parlayed that into a very good career after he got done with tennis, you know, as an analyst. Everybody knows him. Everybody recognizes who John McEnroe is because of his tantrums on
the court
field there. On the court. But I'm telling you, some players actually do that for a reason. She's got to realize that, too. Some players act a little off the wall. They're trying to get reads on other players. They're trying to get a reaction from them. They're trying to put them on tilt. I mean, there's a variety of different things they're doing, and it's part of their strategy. Another thing about it is you have somebody like Daniel Negreanu, who does not irritate people, does not berate people, engages them, and he also is very good for TV. I guess the bottom line is it's a business for these guys from the media. They're going to put on there whatever the customers want to see, and the customers want to see some sort of interaction, something that's going to entertain them. And 10 people sitting around a table, all stoic, showing no emotions, doesn't make good TV. So she makes the conscious efforts and accepts the fact that she's not going to get those endorsements and she's not going to get the recognition that she deserves because she is a tremendous player. Then that's fine, and that's her choice. But, you know, somebody going the other way, they go overboard at times. I'm sorry, the barking would have gotten irritating after a while to me.
I agree.
But,
you know, ESPN,
if they want to do that, boom.
ESPN's in the business of doing entertaining television. Kathy Liebert's in the business of winning poker tournaments. Those two don't always go together. We are all out of time for this week. Next week, Dennis will be traveling to London for the EPT London event. We're going to have a rerun for you of two of our most popular interviews, Jennifer Harmon and Johnny Chan. That'll be next week, and Annie Duke in 2 weeks. Dennis, good luck in Argentina. I'll talk to you then.
All right, take care.
This is the Final Table on 590 The Fan, KFNS, and KFNS.com.